Hey, podcast community, it's Eric, and I've got something exciting for all you online entrepreneurs out there. If you're looking to take your e-commerce store to the next level, you need to check out Aurora Repricer. With Aura, you can effortlessly reprice your Amazon inventory automatically. Ready to elevate your Amazon business? Head over to MilwaukeeMafia.com/Aura. That's A-U-R-A to get started today.
You're listening to Milwaukee Mafia, your podcast dose of Wisconsin Mafia and true crime history.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Milwaukee Mafia Podcast. I'm Eric.
I'm Gavin.
Gavin, we're back again.
Yeah.
What are we talking about today?
So, this is actually kind of a short one, actually really a short one, and honestly not that exciting.
Yeah, so, I think you talked about, I can't remember, I just edited the last podcast we did.
Yeah, so if anybody just wants to skip this one and go on to the next one, like, I don't blame you. It's cool. So this is Joe's Spaghetti House.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And like I said, it's not super exciting, but just getting it out of the way on the timeline, I'm pretty sure this is our last 1964. I could technically do another one. Or two, or, you know, push it. But I think we're ready to go to 65.
Okay, so I'm curious. You said that you wanted to get this one in before we left 64. What is the significance of this story to make you that it plays? Because you said the Spaghetti House didn't last very long.
It didn't last very long. It's not like it's not super important in the story, but because it involves some people who are important to the story, if I don't do it now, then when these people come up again later, then I'll probably have to be like, hey, these guys did this and this. And
so it's more the characters that are involved more so than just the story.
Yeah.
So, gotcha.
Yeah.
All right. So let's hear about a spaghetti house.
Okay. So this starts in February of 1964. There's these two brothers named the Zarn brothers. Not important. But they own the property at 519 West Wells in Milwaukee, and they lease it to Joe and Nea for 2 years. Now, right off the bat, I have to say, all the names that I butcher, I'm always the most self-conscious about Nea. I don't know if it's Nea. I don't know if it's Nea. I don't.
Nea. It could be many different.
Nobody's
versions.
Ever corrected me on it. And so I'm waiting for someone to be like, why are you screwing that up so bad? And nobody does. So I say Nea, but that's probably not right. But just so you know who I'm talking about.
Joe and Nea, because we talked about Jack and Nea, so this would be his son?
This is his son.
Okay.
Yes. So he's leased the property for 2 years. For the first 6 months, he's paying $175 a month. For the second 6 months, it's $200 a month. And then for the second year, it's $225 per month. For the whole second year. They've got like a 2-year plan of how they're going to raise the rent. That's nice. The hired cook at the place was Edward Slawinkowski. Slawinkowski. Wow, this is that's a rough one. As far as I know, he's nobody. I mean, he had a criminal past of vagrancy and being drunk and disorderly, but I mean, who hasn't? It's like, so. I don't think he's anybody. I think he's just a cook. In April of 64, the fire marshal came through, you know, doing their little fire inspection because you got to do that for a restaurant. Strangely, going through with the fire marshal was a special agent of the FBI. I don't know that the people who were running the restaurant knew that, but joining him was a special agent of the FBI. This might come back later in this episode.
Okay.
The FBI continued to make spot observations, and which basically just means like driving by, seeing who's there, looking at license plates.
Am I right to say, is this because Joe and Nea owns it?
Yes.
Probably?
Okay. Yes. So people they would see regularly were Joe and Nea, of course. Walter Broca, who I always refer to as like Frank Belstreet's flunky, like he's like the guy who does a lot of busy work, but he's never really super important. Mm-hmm. John Aiello, and again the cook. So, you know, a couple guys of interest there, nothing too exciting. Special Agent John Gassaway meets with an informant. The informant said that Walter Broca is the one who's actually operating Joe's Spaghetti House, even though the license is in the name of Joe Ania. The basement of the restaurant had a storeroom, but nothing like an office. The basement was not connected to the tavern next door, nor was there any access to the Wells Street Hotel, which must have been nearby. I'm not sure why the agent is curious about the access points in the basement, but, you know, maybe just curious to see how people can get in and out of the building.
Probably just looking like, is there a good way to escape if something goes down?
Yeah.
We need to know about.
Yeah, Agent Gassaway speaks with his informant. The informant now says that a Greek restaurant near Joe's Spaghetti House recently closed, and the cook went to work for Joe's Spaghetti House. The informant thought that the cook did not have a house and was probably sleeping in the restaurant at night. In May, Agent Gassaway was told that the Belmont Coffee Shop was now closing at 8 p.m. rather than being open all night. Traditionally, the Belmont Coffee Shop was really a very sketchy place. It's in the Belmont Hotel. As it says, it was open 24 hours. And pimps would hang out there. Other criminal-type people would hang out there. Primarily, it catered to the after-hours bar crowd and people in entertainment who were getting out super late. So not all shady people, but a mixture of people. You know, people who hang out at coffee shops at 2 or 3 in the morning are questionable people. So it was catering to that group of people. But now, it was going to be closing at 8 o'clock. The reason that they changed this, according to the Belmont Coffee Shop, was because a great many sexual perverts were frequenting the place, and they didn't really want to put up with that anymore. The change likely meant that these questionable people at the Belmont would probably start hanging out at Joe's Spaghetti House instead, because it was nearby. Good for Joe's Spaghetti House. Again in May, informant told Agent Gassaway that Joe's Spaghetti House would run into trouble sooner or later because Walter Broca and Joe Ania have conflicting personalities, so they can't really be running it together. Also, the restaurant is a known hangout for August Maniacci and John Aiello, but nobody from the Balestrieri faction of the mob would go there. So, like, John Aiello and August Maniacci, these guys are super tight. They're often business partners. They're good friends. And they kind of have their own little mini group in the mob of guys who don't like Frank very much.
Okay.
So, like, if they're hanging out here, and they're probably talking a lot of crap about Frank because Frank doesn't go there.
Yeah. It's their vent about Frank place, kind of.
Yeah. By the end of May, Agent Gassaway's informant said his prediction had been correct. And Walter Broca had a falling out with Joe Ania. Ania left Joe's Spaghetti House, and Broca is now running it by himself. Ania went on to be a bartender at the Downtowner, one of Frank Balestrieri's places. In June, an informant told Agent Gassaway that two black men from Chicago were hanging out at Joe's Spaghetti House and were narcotics pushers. The informant said it was possible that Broca was buying dope off of them to supply to showgirls that hang out in the restaurant. And they didn't specify, but typically narcotics at this time would be like heroin.
Okay.
So it could be anything, but that's typically what like narcotics used to mean. In August, Broca briefly closed Joe's Spaghetti House for remodeling. It was open shortly thereafter.
You said that this Brokoff guy is running this restaurant now, and Joe Ania's kind of stepped away.
Yeah.
Is he still the owner of it, though, at this point?
He's still on the license, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So now at this point, now in September of 1964, the place opened in February. They had their fire inspection in April. Now in September, this is the first time that I'm aware of this. Okay. Apparently, somewhere in the building is a hidden microphone, which is identified as microphone 648-C. And they overhear notorious gambler Sid Brodson on the microphone. Sid Brodson doesn't matter to this story. What's interesting is that there's apparently this hidden microphone, and I don't know where it came from. So my suspicion is that way back in April, when the agent was doing the fire inspection with the fire marshal, they put it in then. I don't know that, but that's my guess. But the weird part about that is between April and September, I don't know anything of that's been recorded.
So
apparently months have gone by where they've picked up nothing of interest.
And there should you should even be able to access records just with, because even if they're just listening to it and there's nothing there, right? They should have records of what they listen to and just have it say that nothing notable was found.
They would, yeah. I mean, it's entirely possible that those records have been destroyed. But, yeah, I mean, they would still have had somebody keeping notes. But, yeah, it's just, it's weird that it doesn't, that those notes don't seem to show up anywhere.
Have you ever heard of an instance where they would put something like that in and then just wait a period of time just to kind of make sure that the dust settles and nobody's aware that it's there before they start using it? Have you heard of an instance like that? Or
not that I can think of. I guess it's possible, but pretty much like at this point, again, hidden microphones are not legal. Mm-hmm. The FBI cannot do this.
Yeah, that was actually going to be one of my other questions.
They do it anyway, but they can't, they're not supposed to do it. So pretty much when they do it, like they're supposed to be telling their superiors like what information they're getting to justify them doing it, which is always really questionable. Because anything they get, they can't really use later. So it's like, it's great for gathering information. It's terrible if they ever want to bring any of these guys in for anything. So, I don't know. It's a strange... Then, you know, because it's illegal, they can get really sued for that. I mean, you're not going to get arrested because you're the FBI, but you'd get sued real bad, so... Yeah, so I think this is really odd that it took this long for the microphone to show up. And as far as I know, the microphone never really does anything. So that's September, they pick up Sid Brodson. It doesn't show up again until November, at which point an unknown man is overheard on the microphone asking a waitress where his .38 revolver was that he loaned out. She told him... She sold it, but that's doesn't help me at all because I don't know who the guy is. I don't know who the waitress is. Just some casual conversation they jotted down a note about. By December of that year, the FBI was hearing conflicting stories about Joe's Spaghetti House. There was talk that Broca had brought in another man to operate the restaurant on a 50-50 basis. There was talk the restaurant was losing money. There was talk that Broca was waiting for another place called Time Insurance to buy out his lease just to get out of there. In addition to the restaurant, Broca now had an Avis truck that he was using to buy and sell scrap metal out of. So apparently he wasn't doing good enough off the restaurant to live off of. And then within days of that, they find out that Broca had closed Joe's Spaghetti House and was planning to go to California. Broca was scared. He owed a lot of money, the business was in Joe and A's name, and with Joe being quote-unquote Frank's boy, this could cause him trouble. So that's one thing. And then apparently also John Aiello was trying to get money out of a sucker, but Broca ruined the plan. An informant thought it was possible that Broca even got the sucker before Aiello did. So he overheard a plan to screw a guy out of money, and then Broca stepped in and did the thing himself. With the restaurant closed in December and early February, the microphone at Joe's Spaghetti House was removed. So yeah, super short, just to kind of bring along the story of Walter Broca and Joe and Nea a little bit. Broca does move to California for a while. He doesn't get in any real trouble over this or anything. The Joe and Nea Frank Balestrieri thing has always been interesting because I've never been clear on the connection between Joe's dad and Frank. I don't know if they were friends or if Frank was involved in his murder. Like, I don't know what side he came down on that because there's so many, like, unknown things about some of those 1950s murders. I don't know what side Frank was on. But it's interesting that regardless of how it came down, that Frank basically kind of like took him in and always offered him jobs. And like I said, I don't know if that's because he was friends with his dad or if this was kind of like, you know, now I'm going to take care of you because I'm responsible for your dad's death. Like, I don't know how that plays out. So it's an interesting dynamic. And although Joe is never really anybody of any importance, he's just always around as a bartender, he does sort of get that special favor.
So Joe, you would say really not a mafia member per se, probably just kind of running in those circles.
Yeah, I think he does get officially made a member at one point, but I don't know exactly like why, if it's just sort of like an honorary, like, hey, you've been good to us, we'll let you in. Because he's, you know, he got a file open on him like everybody else did. And he never really was involved in anything. Like, he wasn't even a gambler. Like, mm-hmm. he was just a bartender. But he was around everybody. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he probably knew some stuff. But
yeah, and he probably just had a good enough relationship with enough people that got him into... I mean, I guess, wouldn't you equate it to... The mafia and a gang are very similar in nature. And if you're friends with a bunch of guys that are in the mafia, just they don't need to have a reason to make you part of the mafia. They just kind of, they're like, this guy's cool, let's let him in.
Yeah.
You know,
it's kind of odd, you know, but yeah.
And not to mention on top of that, like you said, he was always a bartender and Frank needed bartenders.
Oh, yeah, he always needed bartenders.
So maybe he was just considered one of those dependable bartenders that got him enough statute that he's like, yeah, you're part of the family.
Yeah.
Because you're helping our businesses run.
But, like, that's it. this not super exciting episode, but I want to get it out there because Joe's going to come up again. Walter Broca's going to come up. Walter Broca's like a... I don't want to say a major figure because that's overselling him, but he's been around quite a bit. I should point out as well that Broca was very good friends with Joe's dad. Like when Jack and Nea was killed, like Walter Broca was with him that entire day, you know, so they were really tight. It could be a similar thing on his end as well, where like, I wanted to go in business with you because I was such close friends with your dad. You know, I knew you since you were a child sort of thing. So Joe, like, grew up just knowing everybody.
And I find Walter Brokoff to be kind of interesting because based on the story you just told, it seems like he ran to California because he was afraid for his life.
Yeah.
I mean, it strongly suggests that. But then now you're saying he comes back.
He'll come back, yeah.
And he actually meddles with the mafia again.
Yeah.
When he returns, so...
Yeah.
So maybe that's not why he ran, or...
He's a strange guy. Like I say, like, I refer to him as, like, the flunky, which I'm getting, you know, very biased reports, obviously. But, like, he's always put on these like, crap jobs. Like, he runs a restaurant and he fails at it. He was previously involved in, like, refurbishing the jukeboxes, and that business went under... And like he's like always put on these things where like, hey, I'm gonna make you build things. Like at one point he was working construction, and to cut costs working construction, like he hires homeless guys as day laborers, which is nothing wrong with that. Like giving homeless guys work is awesome, but they didn't know anything about construction, so it was really crappily done construction. Mm-hmm. Like just this guy just half-asses everything he touches.
Interesting. That whole dynamic is just interesting to me because are we going to hear a little bit of a story of what brings him back? Is there
I don't recall exactly how it plays out. We'll have to see when we get there. But we're not done with him. Like, he's just always around.
Yeah, and it just seems like if he ticked off enough people to the point where he had to run to California, makes me think that him coming back isn't going to be a welcome thing, and he would be watching over his back the whole time.
Yeah.
He's
an interesting guy. And actually, one more thing I'll throw out there, just because this is a short one, I can throw random crap in there. Brokaw was named one of the top 10 hoodlums. Like, when in 1957, when they had like the top 10 hoodlum program and they made each office pick the 10 guys, he made the list of top 10. And I would definitely not put him on that list. And that's probably more a reflection on the level of intelligence the FBI had in 1957, that they didn't know who should have been top 10, and he was just one of the guys that was always around.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting that he made the cut, because to me, if you asked right now, I couldn't name all 10 guys. I don't remember who all the 10 were. But he's not a top 10 guy.
you're like, you probably could list 50 people that should be ahead of him.
Well, I don't know about 50. I don't know about 50. But like, if you made a top 20 list, like, he's on the low end of the 20. So, yeah. It's interesting that he got such huge coverage early on when, in my view, he amounts to practically nothing. He's just the guy who's always around and fails.
But I can see why he would possibly make that list, just because it seems like he was kind of front-facing on a lot of things. You're talking...
He is.
A mob-associated restaurant, he's running it. Like you said, the refurbishing of jukeboxes, he's the guy running it. And they probably clearly knew that that business was also mob-fronted.
Yeah.
You know, so... So he probably looks like a much bigger figure than he really is.
He's around a lot. And I think part of that is with the list coming out in 57, Jackie Nao was killed in 55. So at that point in time, the FBI was aware of that. Even though they didn't really have anything to do with investigating it, they were aware of it. Walter's name probably carried a little more weight. You know, maybe unfairly, but at least, like, it was out there. It was in the papers.
Mm-hmm.
So that might have had something to do with the choice of adding him. It's just funny in retrospect because, like, if you told me to make a list, like I said, of the top 10 guys in the 60s and 70s, like, he's not making the list. He's just not.
Yeah, especially since it seems like he had no success whatsoever. Which brings up the other side point of... Why did the mafia keep giving him opportunities if he just continually failed and failed?
I don't know. You know.
Like you said, he was really tight with Joe. So maybe Joe just had enough cred that he could keep giving him.
I don't know. It doesn't make sense. There's got to be a reason, but I don't know what it is. And he has no family connections.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have tried my damnedest. Like, most of the guys in Milwaukee, I can link through blood or marriage. Walter Broga just can't.
There's nothing there.
It maybe somebody out there can correct me on that, but I have tried, and he's not related to anybody. His wife, I don't believe, is related to anybody. I don't know, you know, that's not unusual. I mean, a lot of guys have no connections at all. But for him to be like this tight in there, screw up and be forgiven so often.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what his trick is.
Well, and
he's never named as a guy like on the short list to get whacked. Almost all the gamblers sooner or later
are on that list.
They'll be like, oh, this guy's not paying us. We gotta kill him. That'll come up. You know, even if they don't mean it, they'll throw it out there. You'd never hear them say, oh, freaking Walter.
And maybe it's just simply the fact of when they start up these businesses, they need people to, you know, run them. And
yeah.
He was just a willing participant. And maybe they just didn't have that many willing participants. So they just inevitably just kept falling back to him for everything.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't know. Yeah. Like I said, if somebody out there knows, you know, definitely shoot me a message, because... I have never, of all the emails and conversations I've had with people, I don't know that I've ever had a Walter Broca conversation. I've had a lot of people say that they knew various people, you know, but he's not one that like comes up.
Nobody knew, just maybe not a lot of family connections here or something.
I don't know.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
All right. So you got anything else for this one, or should we wrap her up?
Yeah, we can just wrap this one up.
All right. So this concludes 1964 for sure.
I think so, because really the only other thing is if I wanted to talk about the California Cheese Company, and I think we can just, we'll do it sooner or later, but nobody wants to hear another cheese story.
All right, so that'll wrap this episode up. As always, we do have a Patreon. You can check that out at patreon.com/MilwaukeeMafia. And Gavin, where can people reach out to you?
You go to MilwaukeeMafia.com, where the show notes will be posted. Sometimes I post them before we even record. Sometimes I post them 2 weeks later. Depends when I get around to it. Or otherwise, you can email directly at MilwaukeeMafia@gmail.com.
And we just want to thank everybody again for tuning in. We will be back next week with a Patreon episode, in 2 weeks with another Mafia episode. Thanks everybody again for tuning in.
Thanks for tuning in to the Milwaukee Mafia Podcast. Join us next time for another look back at Wisconsin Mafia and true crime history.